Sustainability Lens on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio here tonight at 7 o'clock and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
I'm with Dr. Lisa Nathan, who's from the University of British Columbia. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, let's start with the easy question. Tell me about yourself.
Okay. I am currently working as an assistant professor at the iSchool at the University of British Columbia. I've been there for almost 3 years. And before that, I had a pretty non-traditional path. I used to work at the oxymoron known as ecotourism. So I was a sailboat captain down in the U.S. Virgin Islands, taking people on day sail. So I've come a long way since then. It feels like I've had many careers. And most recently I was working on my dissertation work with people who live in intentional communities who are really excited and devoted to living very sustainable lifestyles. They're eco-villages. So that's where I spent quite a bit of time over the last few years.
So let's go back to sailboats.
Yes.
How did you get there?
I got there because after completing my college degree in education, which was very theoretical and aspirational, I worked in the public school system for just a little bit and realized that that was going to suck the life out of me, and I decided to leave the States and head to the Virgin Islands on the beginning of a world tour, and I got stuck there because it was so incredibly beautiful. And I stuck around doing all sorts of odd jobs, housekeeping and working in construction, and then started doing a lot of freediving and sailing, and became more and more interested in both the historical and the environmental social milieu I was living in. And the sailing led to more sailing, and then there was a hurricane, and a sailboat got washed up and was basically totaled and went into my price range of $3,000, and I bought it and fixed it up and started sailing for a living.
Wow. But you're not doing that now.
I'm not doing that now. Now I then returned to the States and went to get my master's in library and information science, and at the end of that process, I was felt like I had learned just enough about research to realize I knew too little and wanted to learn more. I was particularly interested in technology and the fascination that we have around digital technologies, we being people in general, and particularly within academia. I saw a lot of technological determinism. Technology is going to do this, this, and this for us. But then I also knew of people who had a very different idea about that and who were really questioning their use of different technologies, and I wanted to do research with them. So I went into a doctoral program with a pretty solid idea of the people that I wanted to work with, and I wanted to bring their voices into the academic realm. So came a longer process than I ever imagined.
So where did you do your master's?
I did my master's at Simmons College in Boston and my PhD at the University of Washington's Information School.
So what did you do a master's thesis?
No, there was not a thesis at Simmons College, so it was just coursework that I did there.
And so then you went to...
Then I moved across from Boston.
With a strong idea of what you wanted to do?
Yes, I did have a strong idea. I didn't really know what that meant when I said I wanted to do research and I wanted to do all of this. I really had no idea of what the academic lifestyle was like or the process of research, and I had a very naive idea of sort of this researcher going in and learning things about a community, all of that, and then realized in a very humbling process by actually working with not subjects, but participants, people who guided me very patiently in my dissertation work, and those being the people in the communities that I worked with. So I lived and worked, visited many, many times. There were two different communities, one in the Pacific Northwest and one in the I guess you'd say the plains of the U.S. So both communities within the United States.
What sort of communities?
They're called eco-villages.
Okay.
So these are people who live, they're co-located and have decided to live a sustainable lifestyle. Both communities, although people were living on the same piece of property, one community was in a town and the other one was kind of out in the boonies. And those two communities made those decisions quite intentionally. Of course, the one in town wanted to show, be a showcase for people to come by and see how they could live more sustainably in their own neighborhoods. And because of that decision, they faced a lot of challenges in local zoning, laws that were in place. And the other community that was more in a much more rural area chose that because they wanted to do things that were more kind of off the map. Not only were they off the grid, but they were doing very innovative things with things such as human waste, where they had their own human waste system. So they were not tapped into the whole septic system within their community. So that was something they just wanted to be a little bit less on the radar about.
That doesn't sound like something that you would go to a board of studies of an information school and say, I want to do this.
Right. So that was a lot more complicated than I imagined. But they were very open at the information school when I found supportive committee members who were quite intrigued at looking at the way I was framing it was as people's information practices, so how they share, store information. So I didn't go in only looking at digital information tools. I was looking at the way they use paper, the way they use bulletin boards, all these different ways that people have and have had. In our Western North American culture, it tends to be paper, right? Lots of books and things.
So let me just step through this. You're sailing in the Virgin Islands, and that sounds extremely present. Why would anyone want to stop that? I've no idea. And so you thought you want to help with some sort of social change for good.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you decided to go and do computing. That doesn't seem like a logical step.
So I wouldn't call myself a computer scientist. I wouldn't even call myself an information scientist because I think that's just a bizarre term. But I am interested in information and how we share information with each other, the relationships there. So to me, the way that I make up my story of my life is about, I kind of dropped out for a while in some ways, or thought that I was, and I realized that actually being, you know, anywhere present as a human being, you're in. You don't, there's no such thing as dropping out. So, when I was sailing, I would have these amazing people who would come sail with me. My boat was, because of the being in the hurricane and being underwater, the engine didn't work. And I decided not to fix it because, hey, it's the Virgin Islands, there's wind, there's water, who needs an engine? That would scare some people. They didn't want to go out on a boat without an engine. So I got risk takers who would go out with me, people who really wanted to enjoy the vibe, not any kind of destination thing. And I would talk to these people and hear about their lives and the professions they were engaged in, and I kept realizing I wanted to learn more. I wanted to go back to school. You know, I wanted to engage in the culture going on around me in a richer way than I was able to do sailing every day.
Okay, but...
But
you still chose... Information science, masters in library and information science rather than sociology or geography or any of the other things that would...
But so much of our interactions today happen through these digital and information media. So to me it's a natural place. And the more that I read and the more, so reading things like, cybernetics and even Ivan Illich, you know, the tools for conviviality, these very influential pieces that I had the experience of reading demonstrated to me how much our interactions with each other in contemporary times are through these tools, and I wanted to both look at our practices around these tools and the tools themselves, because I think they're so incredibly important to how we understand our place in the world.
Do you think you doing that work, this eco-villages work, did that influence your colleagues who were perhaps doing something more traditionally based?
I think some of them found it inspirational. It might not have changed my particular colleagues, but definitely I've had many students come up to me who learn about my work and want to learn more, not just about the work itself, but about the choices that I made to go off sort of the beaten path in the kind of work that I do and continue to do. But at least I don't have a religious belief where I think I'm going to live more than one time, so I'm trying to make the most of my one shot.
So the eco-villages work, that led to other work?
It did. At the same time that I was doing the eco-village work, because of my interest in my work with the eco-village is a lot of discourse there is around thinking longer term. So that has become this ongoing theme in the various projects that I do, is thinking and broadening how long what sort of time periods we think on within computer science, within the technical world. It's very easy to get on very short time frames, where 6 years seems like a really long time. So because of my interest in the longer term, I started thinking about issues that face humanity and societies that last for a long time. So sustainability clearly is one of those issues. Another one is colonialism. You know, has influences for many, many generations. Another one would be a war or genocide. So other projects that I've worked on while doing the eco-village work was the project in Rwanda, the Voices for the Rwanda Tribunal project, which I was heavily involved in at the University of Washington, that was working with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Or it was a project where we were doing interviews with members of the tribunal, getting their reflections on being a part of this international justice system that was trying criminals, trying people who were accused of atrocities, and yet the people who these atrocities influenced so much, the people of Rwanda, knew almost nothing about what was going on in the tribunal. So this was a project to help to bring the material, to bring the work of the tribunal to the people in Rwanda, or at least that's where it began. But then it's also now a system. How do you build an information system to hold this information that can be adaptable over time, be accessible to the various generations that might want to use this information? So it's a very small collection, a few terabytes of data, but it's a sort of a manageable collection to begin to explore some of the questions around long-term access to digital media in a very politically contested area. So that was another
project. And when you're saying over time, I'm thinking of the New Zealand case where the New Zealand government said sorry, and it was important to do so. And the Australian government has been hanging on not saying sorry until only recently, and that's 200 years.
Yes.
So you're thinking, how do we get that story told for 200 years?
Yes.
Or longer.
Or longer, yeah, and to really seriously consider that. And perhaps there's, you know, it's not that there's one decision or one right answer here, but if we don't discuss it and make active decisions around it, there will be nothing to save, you know. I think there's a lot of projects right now where people aren't necessarily thinking about longer term. They're making these amazing digital collections, but if they'll be accessible in 2, 3, 5 years, 10 years, remains to be seen, because people, again, are just thinking of now rather than the longer term.
So when you were when you were interviewing people, the people you were interviewing was the tribunal itself,
right,
and the lawyers and the people around the system?
The prosecutors, the lawyers, the translators, the interpreters, the judges, and we were asking them not about, what we were asking them was to, what was the information, what would you want the people of Rwanda to know? Because the tribunal itself was held thousands of miles away from the people who were affected. There were reasons for that. The United Nations Security Council created the tribunal at a time that Rwanda didn't have the infrastructure because of the atrocities and the genocide. And that happened in the early 90s, but you know, as time went on and Rwanda became stronger and rebuilt its infrastructure, there were lots of questions of why are we spending so many millions of dollars on a tribunal that's so far away? So these people who we were interviewing were reflecting on, these are the things that went well, these are the things that went really horribly. But when you think about long-term issues and you think about justice, is it justice if the people within Rwanda don't know about it?
That was my next question, or sort of my next question. You were interviewing the mechanism, but not the people involved. You weren't interviewing the witnesses and that sort of, those sort of
no,
people, were you?
No, there are projects that do that, but we were interviewing the actual people who were involved in the system, because there was so much about the system that just was unknown, and there was a lot of, questions. Like, we were not in an agreement with the ICTR. They did not know what questions we were asking. They did not ask to see any of the material. I'm much more used to being in your position as an interviewer than an interviewee. So we would go in and people were so human. I don't know how else to say. They had so much to say. They had so many concerns about the work that they were doing and about, you know, things they had seen that really left them distressed. The people who worked in the tribunal revisited the genocide every day for years. So these were people who were incredibly affected by their daily life in terms of their career choice to work in this area, and they wanted to share some of their understandings with the people in Rwanda, and this was one vehicle to do so. But the work there wasn't just the interviewing, that was just to create the collection, but the work was in creating a system, an information system that would be accessible. So we're talking about Rwanda. Do people even what kind of system are we going to create where people can access this? So it's not just a digital system. Yes, there's a website. You can download the high-quality video of these interviews. You can download audio, but we've also worked on paper prototypes, other ways for people to get the information into Rwanda, and all of those different things. Then how do you have those last over time? So it quickly becomes a very complicated project, but it is ongoing. So we made a trip back to Rwanda and made films with youth to help them learn about filmmaking, but also to give their voice to how they view Rwanda, how they view the international justice system. Very compelling project. And then now that team, there's another team going back to Rwanda to continue this work, but I'm now moved on to more of a consulting role with that particular project. As I've moved to British Columbia, and I'm much more interested now in doing work in my local environment rather than traveling halfway across the world to do work. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of issues that have long-term repercussions in my own area.
Mm, just finishing off with the Truth and Reconciliation. No, that's not what it's called. That's the one you're doing.
Right.
War Crimes Tribunal.
Yeah, right? The project is called the Tribunal Voices Project, and that's with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda.
Because these things, I was trying to think, there's that one and there's Yugoslavia.
Yes, the ICTR.
Cambodia's just started, hasn't it?
And there's also now the International Criminal Court, which is at The Hague. So the UN has tried all different models trying to figure out, you know, we're making this up, of course. What is international justice? What's the right way to go about it? And unfortunately, we keep having ways and situations where we get to try again, unfortunately, and they've tried different models. So there have been many of them.
So they'll, you know, as well as the long-term history, what mm-hmm. you're doing is documenting something in a way that when they have to set up the next one, because I'm sure there will be, unfortunately, they might learn from
yes.
from that work.
Some of the work that has gone on, although there's work in Rwanda, and that to me is some of the most compelling work, there are many educational human rights groups, people who are training the next generation of lawyers and prosecutors and judges who are beginning to use that material because it's incredible. It's just so rich with insights for somebody who is then going to be working in that area of human rights and justice, international criminal justice. But that part of it is a little bit easier because these are people who are often in a very privileged position, so getting access to the material is a lot easier than for those who are in Rwanda.
So you now in...
I'm now in Vancouver. Yep.
And you were looking around to say, how can I do this same sort of thing locally? Is that the idea?
Yeah, yes. Actually, it appeared, or I hope it will appear. It's a very much an ongoing thing, but I have, in my role at the Information School at the University of British Columbia, I serve as the First Nations Curriculum Concentration Coordinator. It's a very big name for a very small position, but we have a...
Why concentration?
Because it's not its own program. It's something that people who are going to be maybe information architects or archivists or maybe they'll be librarians, people who are going into these various information fields who have a strong interest in Aboriginal initiatives and supporting those, or maybe they come from a First Nations community and they want to return there and do work in this profession, but they want to have a specific grounding in the particular initiatives and issues that go along with their community. And there's such a politicized and very powerful history within Canada around the Canadian government's relationship and treatment of Aboriginal peoples, and that has repercussions within the information professions that many tend not to recognize or be aware of in terms of issues such as privacy, intellectual property, all of these really high-level issues where our profession tends to take stances such as intellectual freedom, always against censorship, these sort of big issues within the information professions that when you come at them from, say, someone who comes from a First Nation might have a very different cultural understanding of these issues. Other big topics include knowledge organization, what we call things, what we label things. The information systems that we create often have this hierarchical system and a type of labeling, the names of things that just truly do not work for people from First Nations communities. So in that role, as the person who's developing this concentration to develop, it's not something that people will get a degree in, but they will have a line on their transcript that says they've received and engaged in extra intellectual endeavors and practice, professional practice in this area. So students who go into this concentration take courses across the university that widen their understanding or deepen it in terms of Indigenous initiatives and issues, and then they also do a professional experience with a First Nations community or a First Aboriginal-oriented organization. And this just provides them with the very hands-on experience of working with these issues.
That's for people that choose it, isn't it?
It is.
Choose to take that pathway.
Yes.
What about the rest of the students?
So my mission, which is in no way secretive, I have not made a secret of it, is actually to continue to incorporate a lot of the things that we're doing within the concentration throughout the school. And I'm able to do that in one way because I teach one of our incoming classes. So all of the students in our Masters of Library and Information Science program have to take this class with me. And I've actually introduced it into the curriculum. And one of the most amazing things, besides the beautiful location of Vancouver, I tend to live in really gorgeous places. Vancouver has amazing faculty and staff who are working in this area of Indigenous initiatives, so I've been able to get incredible support, such as we have Huihua, it's spelled XWI7XWA, library, which is an Indigenous library within the academic library system. An amazing resource, and they use the John Deere, kind of a modified John Deere classification system, and it's a place where, scholars, students working in that area can actually go to this library and, work with professionals there that are particularly amazing. And our students in our Library and Information Science and Archives program can also go and work with these professionals. We have the Museum of Anthropology, which is a world-renowned institution that has developed amazing protocols for working with First Nations communities. So, again, our students can work with those individuals. It's not been an easy process at MOA, but they've developed protocols and policies for working in a truly respectful manner with First Nations and Aboriginal artifacts that they have. So it's just a great environment for me to learn from all of these other people. And the university itself has relationships with the Musqueam, actually a formal letter of understanding, because the university sits on unceded ancestral land of the Musqueam people and has worked actively with Musqueam to develop initiatives that are mutually beneficial. So it's not that everything is perfect. There's lots of mistakes have been made, and I'm probably making some right now in the things that I'm saying, but we learn from our mistakes, and I think UBC has done an amazing job of learning from its mistakes and not being scared to make them. So rather than taking no moves, it's made some, and one of them being the some people have been working actively in the area of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's going on across Canada right now. It's about halfway through its five-year mission, and this is a commission that's gathering information about the Indian residential school system that was existent in Canada for over 130 years, and the last school closed in the 90s. So these were schools that would, as the government, the Canadian government has recognized, they were trying to take the Indian out of the child, and they did this by taking children out of their families, out of their communities, and educating them on how not to be an Indian. So really horrific implications, both personally for families, for communities, and I'd say across the Canadian populace because of these this governmental policy. So there's now talk of creating an research center to hold the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what I am particularly interested in is the information system that's going to be developed to hold the TRC materials, because Canada is freaking huge. It's this gigantic country. People are spread across it. There's no way you're going to create a physical center that everyone's going to have access to. It just makes sense to do a digital information system. But a digital information system that tries to break down colonial perspectives, now that's interesting. You know, there could be all sorts of amazing things that this information system, kinds of practices that it might be able to support. So that's my next, I hope, a project that I can have a part in, and one that will develop.
So have you started that?
So there's a proposal process that the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, had a call for proposals, and UBC is involved in one of those proposals. So we haven't heard back yet. So well, fingers crossed, we'll see what happens. So, but there's support at the university.
So what are you proposing you do?
The part of the proposal is to have hubs. so that there might be a physical research center somewhere, but there would be a hub at the University of British Columbia in the Vancouver campus, and through that hub, there would be an information system where people would be able to not only access the historical material around the TRC, but also envision what the future of relationships are between the settler community in Canada and the Indigenous community.
Do you ever have students saying, yeah, whatever, but I'm going to go and work for a library in a financial system? This has got nothing to do with me.
Yes. Well, actually, I've never had a student say that. I've had many faculty, not many faculty, I have had people ask that kind of question. I've also had people say, I just had a course approved that has a, that is within our school, that is on information protocols and practices to support Indigenous initiatives, and it has a strong British Columbia focus and a strong First Nations focus, rather than a strong international focus. And there was pushback and questioning of why should we take such a constrained approach? Let's look at this much more broadly. But I think that we need to begin at home. And that's now my home, and for the students who are there, it's their home while they're in university at the school. And there's things that are happening right there in our local environment that we need to learn about and you know, take action on. And just what I was talking about before in terms of when you are working with, for me, I'm non-Indigenous, and when I'm working with Indigenous peoples on the issues of my profession, information systems, information organization, I realize how culturally biased some of the things that I think are quite objective are. And they do a very sometimes gentle, sometimes not so gentle way of helping me learn that. How can that not then help my profession and my professional practice? So that's my answer to the students, is that by working in this area and learning these things, you are going to be a better practitioner throughout your work, because we bring these biases into our work, and by challenging them, I think the work that we do becomes stronger.
Now, we are at CHI, Human-Computer Interaction. Have you been presenting papers?
I haven't presented a paper. I've been organized a panel on policy, and I'm on a social sustainability policy with you tomorrow. And then I organized, was one of the organizers for two workshops, one on sustainability and the other one on HCI for Peace. So this year I didn't have any papers.
So the HCI for Peace was with Juan Pablo.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we interviewed him last year. How did that workshop go?
It went really well. I learned about a lot of projects going on that I probably wouldn't have heard of elsewhere, because unfortunately many people are doing these sorts of projects off the side of their desk. So there was one young man who he's a PhD student, recently graduated from Harvard, and he's working on an interface to help people find landmines. And just an amazing, compelling project. But he was talking about how he'll probably leave his PhD work in order to pursue, because the feedback that he's gotten is that his work is not extending the research enough. He's working on something that has having direct effect on, you know, the number of landmines still being deployed for one thing, but left over from past and current ongoing crises or wars around the world. So these are things that are, you know, blowing off children's legs, and yet he's getting feedback that that's not academic work. So he will likely leave. So those were some of the more compelling conversations that I had during the workshop. So that workshop in particular was really people talking about the work that they're doing, the challenges that they have, and us brainstorming ways for them to continue their work.
And the policy panel? Is that?
So today there was a policy panel that was looking at mostly from a federal level, but how people working in the area of interfaces and interaction design, and trying to encourage them to do more work with public policy individuals at multiple levels, but particularly at the government level. So when laws are being created, things that deal with people's voting, people's, or SOPA with the internet, these sorts of things, we need to have the academics who are here at CHI talking to the policymakers and influencing them. So this was a panel of people who engage in that work, giving tips of how to do it more effectively and of really making compelling arguments of how they have made changes because of their academic experience influencing public policy at the government, federal level.
And it had a cool name.
Occupy CHI. Yeah. And because, again, this is another area where the academics, some of the powers that be at this particular conference and the reviewing system might not view this work as being related to computer-human interaction, but to me it's at the core of it because we're not just designing technology, we're designing practices and how people engage with the technology, and I think we need to take ownership, and who better to advise policymakers on how technology should be allowed to operate than the people who are designing it.
If somebody was to argue that there isn't space for values in research or perhaps in education, have they got a point?
I think it's a rather weak point. I don't really want to live in the world that they envision, because why are we doing all of this but to improve the human condition? I don't think any of us want to live in a value-free world. I don't even know what that would look like, because they, in that, are expressing their own values around, I guess, maybe scientific objectivity. And it's not that I'm against science, but I am against living in a world with no values.
Being devil's advocate in a very good way, would it be all right for a student to come in and say, I think that the First Nation people deserve nothing. You know, they were born 20 years ago, same as me, get on with it. Can they express that view in your class? And can they, I imagine they can express it, and they'll have to hold it at the end.
I don't know that there's anything that I could do to prevent a student from, I could make things very uncomfortable for them, but when I was mentioning before about how there's incredible support at UBC, we actually have a woman, Amy Perot, who's been working for years on, a few years on, classroom initiatives. It's actually called Aboriginal Issues in the Classroom, and she has provided and created amazing support materials for faculty and for students to engage in just those kinds of topics in the classroom, because I have not had that experience, but I have heard other faculty, whether they're in history or, you know, teaching mathematics or computer science, they tell these stories of, you know, why those issues don't belong here and why they don't influence me. And luckily, I think that these materials help create an environment where students can voice those ideas, if that's what they hold, but then we need to make room to respond and engage in those, because too often students will voice that kind of idea and the faculty are too scared to take it further because they feel as though, ooh, you know, that's getting touchy, that's kind of scary, I don't want to go there. So I think it's really important to engage those and not to rely on the other students in the classroom to make that voice, you know, to be like, oh, I'm neutral, I'm not going to get in here. I think faculty have a responsibility to, you know, bring out the issue and really talk about it in a deep way. So although I haven't had that, it does happen, and there are ways to engage with it. But they fail the class if they still, you know, you're judging the work that they do, so...
So if they can produce a valid argument and substantiation, all those sorts of things, then you're not prejudging the answer.
Yeah, I think that that would be a very interesting way to engage. I haven't faced it, and I don't know how that would go. It would be very unusual student.
It's interesting that, yeah. It's interesting that you haven't come across it, because one of the barriers to people taking on a values-based position is that they feel that they wouldn't be able to deal with that, mm-hmm. that situation, that you know, it's not their role to try and influence values of students.
Yeah.
But you argue that it is, and they should face it.
Well, I think it would be important for the student or someone who holds that position to, like you say, build the argument and at least demonstrate that they understand what the others are. But if the student develops, and I'm kind of big on the whole, I go to the real premises and, you know, strong premise and the argument and all of that, then that's the work that I'm grading. And I think we have to agree to disagree. And that's okay. That's if you can't do that in academia, I don't know where you can.
So what's next?
Hopefully, working in some way with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission Research Center, and also continuing to work in the area of policy and designing policy around these information issues. Those are all. There's so much next, and we've been talking for such a long time. I'm so sorry. I get a little excited about what I do. I really enjoy it.
And do you miss the sailing?
I don't have to miss it, because now my daughter has gotten into it. She's actually going to the U.S. Nationals in just a couple of weeks and sailing, so we have a small boat. I do miss the warm weather.
Thank you very much. I've been talking to Dr. Lisa Nathan from the University of British Columbia Information School. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Sustainable Lens on Radio, the weekly show broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Thursday night from 7 to 8. Regular panellists are Shane Gallagher and Samuel Mann. At our website, www.sustainablelens.org, we can get podcasts of our previous show, is managed by Elizabeth Simmons. You can look us up on iTunes as well. My name is Anton Angelo, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.